It is still a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It is a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. In January, Hannah Wells and I began a Worship Associates program, a program that Vicki Rao and I are continuing for members of the church who would like to take more active and creative parts in worship services. And Colleen McKenzie is one of our Worship Associates who will now offer her affirmation of faith.
By celebrating Thanksgiving, our culture has chosen to reserve a day to reflect and to be grateful. Most of the time, for many of us, finding thankfulness may seem effortless. However, each of us will experience losses and disappointments at various times in our lives. Some will be visible to others, and some will be seen by only ourselves. How can we be grateful at times when the difficulties seem to block the blessings from view? We can choose to take a step back, to look at the big picture with a fresh perspective. For me, the process of stepping back has included remembering the grading policy of one of my high school teachers. He told the class that if anyone wanted to complain about the mark he gave for a particular test answer, he might also reevaluate his marking on the rest of the test. There was less grumbling in that course, as students who felt entitled to more marks for one answer were also amazed by the teacher's generosity in other sections. He ensured that we all paused to look at the big picture before complaining. Though he may have just been trying to reduce the number of disgruntled students he'd have to face, he offered me a life lesson that would guide me when, many years later, I'd have to accept the diagnosis and effects of multiple sclerosis. Perhaps the key to feeling thankful instead of grumbling is to move beyond our sense of entitlement, or at least to re-examine it. Fine, I didn't deserve to get MS. Illness is never fair. But was I any more entitled to be born into my fabulous family? Or to complete university while still being able to scurry frantically between my classes? And how could I complain much when I recognized the gift of being trained as a writer, a profession that actually requires a lot of sitting down? And what about the blessing of being married to my wonderful husband? Overall, MS could be seen as just one bad card in the otherwise stellar hand that I've been dealt. Getting MS was disappointing, but I would never want to submit my whole life for reevaluation. I've received my share of grace. I'm thankful. Michael J. Fox described Parkinson's disease as the gift that keeps on taking. And I feel the same could be said of MS. For through all it takes, it offers back opportunities for personal growth and lessons on recognizing and appreciating the blessings that you do have. Finding joy in what is often taken for granted. For instance, about 12 years ago, when a doctor first suggested that I might have some very early signs of MS, I was offered an intense appreciation of walking, dancing, moving, if I chose to recognize those gifts. I did. When I wanted a real treat, I'd get a coffee and go for a long walk. The feeling of my legs moving easily and rhythmically, got a little tremor going on here, sorry, was no different than all the times that I had taken my ability for granted. But suddenly I could see the gift of it. I chose to see the wonder. Now my walking involves a lot more effort for a lot less speed, but I am thankful for continuing to do it. I'm also excited by the rapid advancements in research, leading to constant improvements in medications and steady advances towards a cure. I follow the progress carefully and am confident that I will walk with ease again. When that time comes, I may not want to do anything but walk, or better yet, run. I might have to take occasional breaks to eat or sleep, but I'll make Forrest Gump look like a couch potato. The joy I found in walking years ago is only one example of finding miracles in the seemingly mundane. When you drink your next cup of coffee, really taste it. Okay, only do that if it's good coffee. Enjoy tonight's bedtime story even more than the kids do. At the start of your next flight, find the thrill of speed. Let the runway release you, and at takeoff, let your spirit soar at least as high as the plane. There is also much joy to be found right here, right now. We've all chosen to come together in celebration in the sacred place. Recognize this experience as the gift that it is and stay a little longer to chat or linger a while in the sanctuary for some peaceful reflection. Later, on Thanksgiving Day, whether celebrating with family or friends or on your own, do something special. Perhaps go for a walk, if you're able, or a spin in your wheelchair to enjoy the cooler fall air. Listen to your favorite songs or read from a beloved book. And tell someone special about the impact they've had on your life, just as I'll be sending this text along to my high school teacher with a note of sincere thanks. Whatever you choose to do, take a step back, find your joy, and be grateful. Happy Thanksgiving.
Now, in the center of our service and the center of our lives, let us make time to honor the quiet moments in life. You may use these first moments for lighting candles of memory and hope, or just sitting quietly remembering who you are and why you are here. This morning's prayer was written by Max Coutts, the emeritus minister of the Unitarian Universalist Church in Canton, New York. It is called, Let Us Give Thanks. Let us give thanks for a bounty of people.
For children who are our second planting, and though they grow like weeds and the wind too soon blows them away, may they forgive us our cultivation and fondly remember where their roots are. Let us give thanks.
For generous friends with hearts and smiles as bright as their blossoms, for feisty friends as tart as apples, for continuous friends who, like scallions and cucumbers, keep reminding us that we've had them.
For crotchety friends as sour as rhubarb and as indestructible, for handsome friends who are as gorgeous as eggplants and as elegant as a row of corn, and for others as plain as potatoes and as good for you. For funny friends who are as silly as Brussels sprouts and as amusing as Jerusalem artichokes, and serious friends as complex as cauliflowers and as intricate as onions.
For friends as unpretentious as cabbages, as subtle as summer squash, as persistent as parsley, as delightful as dill, as endless as zucchini, and who, like parsnips, can be counted on to see you throughout the winter. For old friends nodding like sunflowers in the evening time, and young friends coming on as fast as radishes.
For loving friends who wind around us like tendrils and hold us, despite our blights, wilts, and witherings. And finally, for those friends now gone, like gardens past that have been harvested, and who fed us in their times that we might have life thereafter.
For all these, we give thanks.
It can be difficult to feel thankful when we are filled with other feelings. Maybe you are coming here and feeling discouraged at the politics of the day. and disheartened at the social horizon. Maybe you are feeling afraid for your civil rights, and maybe you are feeling sad or numb at the killing which is going on in the name of America's well-being. Maybe you are angry at the lies and half-truths that wisp over the television screens and radio waves. One way to overcome moods and to build up an attitude of gratitude is to do a little mental exercise I am sure most of you are familiar with, if not habituated to. It's called counting your blessings. You just ignore your current funk and start to review all the things about your life that you appreciate. You remember everything that's going right, progressing smoothly, or thriving silently, like a potted geranium you've brought in from the summer porch that's living out its perennial life, thriving silently, giving you a shot of bright coral red just because you happen to look that way. These are blessings. When you place in your mind all these considerations and just keep counting your blessings, you experience some level of transformation, and a crack appears in your dark mood. If this is not a practice for you already, I suggest picking it up soon. Ask around here this morning. I'm sure you'll find many who can coach you along and give witness to this powerful practice. The times we are living in are bleak, and the time of year is suitably gloomy. Darkness is setting in. The days are noticeably shorter. Makes you feel like you've just got to get home and get into your pajamas. The rainstorms we have been having here this last week have added to the dreariness. So even though the temperatures have been mild, the pull towards seeking shelter inside has been strong. And it feels like there is much to shelter from in the political climate as well. Newspaper headlines appear as writing on the wall as the renewed administration seizes and scopes out the next 4 years. And then there's the whole array of feelings I was talking about earlier. Fear, anger, confusion, depression. It is very hard to celebrate the abundance of life when we know the utter devastation and poverty which is being created on the fields of war. They're not fields, they're city streets, the city streets of Fallujah, Mosul. How can we separate our keen sorrow and despair at the brutal killing, at the material and spiritual destruction? How can we come around the heavy-laden table, feast with family and friends all around? How can we? Do we try to forget? Do we have a few drinks to help? Do we just try to get through the holiday and hope everyone can act normal and decent with each other? Well, what approach do we take? It's not so much a question about coping with the Thanksgiving holiday as it is, I think, about how we connect with revitalizing truths. Here are a couple of suggestions. First, try to connect with the reality of the abundance of the earth, the bounty of life, not in the bogglingly overladen shelves of HEB, but outside. The sky and the air are great gifts to us horizon-seeking air breathers. Breathe the fresh air in deliberately. Realize that it is shared by all living creatures of all times. Let go of the illusion that you are separate from the earth. Keep letting that idea go and see how that feels. How do you feel in that state of reckoning? Can you sense a thankfulness there in that moment? Second, try to connect with someone. How can we bring a sense of the real into the Thanksgiving celebration? Try to widen the circle of inclusion around your table, and more importantly, around your heart and in your thinking. Whatever makes us more inclusive and widens our notion of the boundaries of the human community or family serves God or serves the good. It is practicing liberal religion. Now, I am sure you all know about hospitality and do your mightiest to be with family and to make an inviting feast for your family and friends. Try to imagine an expanded circle of kinship, which includes all people, all living beings, the earth and the unknown. Imagine an expanded feeling of kinship with people who believe very different things about life and death than you do, and imagine what that would do to your point of view. For instance, if you felt such a kinship, you might never feel alone and separate from others, especially because of ideas. You might allow your curiosity to mix with your acceptance of others and begin to give voice to bold questions which are earnest and satisfying. It is hard to imagine, but we can start together here with each other. We can do this as a community, accept each other and encourage each other towards spiritual growth. If that is to happen, we need to take the time to be with one another and to build a trust of one another strong enough to bear both self-revelation and the risky process of seeking understanding of one another. The listening ministers can vouch for this, I'm sure. Cultivating this practice gives us an experience of truly accepting, and this inclusive attitude will characterize us as individuals and as a religious community. The covenant groups, which are small groups of the members and friends of this congregation, are a great way to grow in these paths. And there are new groups starting now if you have not already become involved in this vital ministry. It is hard to love someone when you are confronted with all the complexities of their religious beliefs and all the confusions of their unarticulated certainties. But it is amazing how we all can help others to come to clarity for themselves just by listening to them and trying to understand them using their own terms. It is a learned skill, and it can be difficult at times, but it is real, and it is life-giving, and it creates powerfully real relationships, sacred connections. And such are the gifts which are the blessings to be counted. May there be such bounty among us. May it spread out from each of us and touch all we know.
Holidays are like second chances that keep coming back to us. They're anniversaries of certain themes worth revisiting each year, although this year two anniversaries coincide at this time. The first is Thanksgiving, this uniquely American holiday. It's a holiday for people who've suffered painful losses and need to learn to incorporate them. If everything in your life is just swell, if it's been just swell for as far back as you want to remember, Thanksgiving will be another swell day with turkey. But if you've lost something this year and want to take a hard challenge in the art of life, then Thanksgiving is for you. It was so long ago, the first Thanksgiving, it's hard to imagine it could still be such a big thing. It was 384 years ago when 102 pilgrims left in the Mayflower to come to this country. It was a terrible journey. It lasted 66 days. And when they got here, they were met by a brutal, probably record-breaking Massachusetts winter long before there was a Massachusetts. By spring, of the 102 pilgrims who came here, 47 had died. 55 remained. Half of these pilgrims buried the other half. and then they planted crops and looked for food. The crop was good, there was food. I can't imagine how they must have felt. And by late summer, when they could at last celebrate a good crop, half of those with whom they had hoped to celebrate were dead. The first Thanksgiving, then, not surprisingly, lasted 3 days. There was much eating, drinking, and merriment between the surviving pilgrims and Chief Massasoit and 90 of his people. The menu for the feast still sounds good. It was venison stew cooked over an outdoor fire, spit-roasted wild turkeys stuffed with cornbread, oysters baked in their shells, sweet corn baked in its husks, and pumpkin baked in a bag and flavored with maple syrup. After dinner, legend has it that Chief Massasoit's brother disappeared into the woods and returned with a bushel of popped popcorn, which the pilgrims had never tasted before. These are the bare bones of a story of the first Thanksgiving. We don't have many other details. It was the story of a small group of people who seemed to have both the character and the courage necessary to transform hell into heaven. The scenes reminded me this year of something historian Will Durant said quite a while ago. He was once asked to sum up civilization in half an hour after writing 14 or so volumes on it that no one on earth has ever read. He did it in less than a minute, and he did it this way. Civilization, he said, is a river with banks. The river is sometimes filled with blood from people killing, dying, stealing, shouting, and doing the things historians usually record. While on the banks, unnoticed, people build homes, make love, raise children, sing songs, write poetry, and even whittle statues. The story of civilization is the story of what happened on the banks, he said. Historians are pessimists because they ignore the banks for the river. The American Thanksgiving is like that. In the river, in the background of the first Thanksgiving, were the graves of 47 friends and family, nearly half their number. On the banks, the 55 who survived invited some new friends over and threw a 3-day party to give thanks. That's the first anniversary we have at this time. But this year, this Thanksgiving anniversary is more complex, because yesterday was another anniversary, too. And it's one I have never in my life thought of in conjunction with Thanksgiving until now. It gives a bolder and more stark picture of that river than even the first Thanksgiving story does. For yesterday was the anniversary of November 20th, 1945, the day the Nuremberg war crimes trials began. 20 Germans were put on trial, as they were told, not for losing a war, but for starting it. Among the 20 were two editors of German newspapers who published the government's propaganda so willfully that they were seen as co-conspirators in the murderous war crimes that the propaganda enabled. I read the original story as it appeared on that date in the New York Times, and I want to read you just the opening paragraph of that story. Nuremberg, Germany, November 20th, 1945. Four of the world's great powers sit in judgment today on 20 top Germans whom the democratic nations charge with major responsibility for plunging the world into World War II. The 21st defendant, tacitly, although not specifically named in the indictment, is the German nation that raised them to power and gloried in their might. That last sentence is the one that stopped me cold. The 21st defendant, tacitly, although not specifically named in the indictment, is the German nation that raised them to power and gloried in their might. These were the obedient citizens known ever since then as the good Germans. Those who their country applauded for being good citizens because they did not question the actions of the government. They stayed on the banks, and they ignored the bloody river which their own government was creating, and history will never forgive them for it. They celebrated, they had their parties, they had their Thanksgivings, and their lives went on. But at that time, in that place, that was not sufficient. History believes, as I also believe, that they had a moral duty to do what was within their power to stop the blood pouring into the river beside them. With the anniversaries of Thanksgiving and the start of the Nuremberg war crimes trials coming at the same time, it raises the challenge of Thanksgiving to a whole new level. It doesn't change the fundamental challenge of it, it just complexifies it. But it does say, as both the Nuremberg trials and the verdict of history have said, that living well on the banks of that bloody river does not mean we may ignore what's going down the river. In fact, we may be held accountable for it. The German leaders were held accountable legally, and the German people were convicted by the opinion of nearly everyone in the world. That happened after Hitler claimed the right to a preemptive invasion of Poland in 1939. That was the crime which began World War II. The next significant preemptive invasion of a sovereign nation happened last year, when President Bush claimed the right to invade Iraq, a country which had nothing at all to do with 9/11 and posed no threat to us. 59 years ago, we told Germany these were war crimes punishable in many cases by death. Every Thanksgiving has its version of those graves in the background, in the bloody river, next to the banks on which we build homes, make love, raise children, sing songs, write poetry, and whittle statues. When the deaths are visited upon us, we are challenged to grieve them without letting them poison our lives or take away our gratitude and hope. That's the traditional challenge of Thanksgiving. But when we visit the deaths on others, if history is a guide, we must not only grieve them, but also do our best to stop them. For if life is the ultimate gift, then the willful and unprovoked destruction of others' lives is the greatest of all crimes against humanity. We cannot afford the moral cost of being good Americans if it means failing to question the kinds of actions that we once prosecuted another nation for as war crimes. If we do, the phrase good Americans may take on the same ironic, painful meaning we gave to the phrase good Germans 6 decades ago. So our challenge this Thanksgiving is at least twofold. First, we must see what is in that bloody river, ask how it got there, and decide whether we think we have the moral obligation to try and stop all the killing. And second, we must not let rage, vengeance, or angry determination poison our lives and rob our souls of their nuance and their balance. It is a spiritual balancing act worthy of the very best that is in us. We must give heed to the moral actions of our nation, for which history will hold us accountable, and we must not let it blind us to the fact that, as bloody as the river is, the lives we enjoy on our banks are still precious and still worth giving thanks for. Holidays are like second chances that keep coming back to us. At this most complex Thanksgiving, may we seek the delicate and necessary balance between the moral awareness of our contributions to that bloody river and our spiritual appreciation for the great gift of life both here and abroad. May we give a rest to our habits of complaining that life is not perfect long enough to recognize that the gift is miraculous, precious, terribly vulnerable, and fleeting. Let's not pass it by without stopping to give thanks. And may our actions also make it more likely that others, whose lives our armies and corporations touch, may also have the opportunity to give thanks for their own lives. Amen.